Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Now in depth on what millennial diversity really means. It's more than numbers, and here's why. Millennials may be the most diverse generation in American history. Here in Minnesota, more than one in five millennials is a person of color. But that doesn't mean they define diversity the way you'd expect. It also doesn't mean that their views on race are as tolerant or as informed as you may think. Here's NPR Code Switch writer Gene Demby recently on what he calls the myth of the colorblind millennial.
The conventional thinking about millennials is that they, or I suppose we, as I'm a millennial myself, are, you know, this multicultural, especially tolerant generation that is really open to sort of cross-cultural exchange, is really tech-savvy. And, you know, the idea that millennials are especially racially progressive or forward-thinking on race is a bit overstated. I mean, if you dig down into poll numbers, you don't tend to see that borne out very much.
So millennials, what do you think about this? If you're between the ages of 18 and 34, do you think the diversity of your generation gives you special insight or acceptance of racial issues? Do you think you're free of the racial baggage that older generations have confronted and not so successfully? So think about this. Think about how you and your peers and your friends and your work colleagues interact, talk about issues of race. Compare that with older generations and then call in or tweet in 651-227-6000. 800-242-2828. Conversation going on at mprnews.org. And I'm hearing from you on Twitter already. It's at Kerri, K-E-R-R-I, MPR. Our guest today, Jose Santos, is a professor of anthropology at Metro State University. He's with me in the studio. Good to have you back. Thank you for coming.
Thank you so much, Kerri.
Reiner Spencer is director of the African-American Studies Program and chief diversity officer at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. And he's with us from Las Vegas, where it's a little early. So, Reiner, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Thank you. John, I am just waking up here.
Okay, well, good to have you here. Jose, first a historical sense, I guess, of how unprecedented the diversity of the generation is, because that's noteworthy. Do they look significantly different than the generations that have preceded them?
Yes, yes. If we look at the statistics, and particularly if we look at the growth of multiracial Americans, we can say, looking at the statistics, that it's almost doubled in size since 2000. Now, that's misleading because we didn't actually start counting it until 2000. So, how you want to break that down is you're kind of left on your own. But if we look at the numbers, yeah. What that also tells us, once we start tracking these things, is that our awareness of them has grown. So what we can say is that millennials are growing up in a context where these things are much more at the forefront. They are things that you look at when you fill out a census form. They are things that come up on the radio shows and so on. So that context is different. It's a very different social context.
Has this largely been driven by immigration?
It's immigration. So you got to understand, I mean, how drastically the fact that, I mean, why is it such a hot topic now, immigration, how drastically it's really changed the fabric of our society, right? Okay. And you also have to look at the history, that the history of immigration is largely a racial history. It is a history of people coming in, getting racialized, and then the more and more they become mainstream, they become less racialized. And, you know,
when you use the term racialized, what do you mean?
For example, you know, the classic example is the Irish, right? So if you look at them, Irish people look white. Right, they look white European, just like the English, just like the French. When they arrive, however, they're immigrants. They're different. They sound different. They act different. They have different customs. There's that Irish race, right? And you get the whole Irish need not apply thing, and so they become racialized. And that the history of a lot of immigration is about how do we become sort of this non-pathological race entity and more mainstream. Whereas now we have a lot of influx of Latino immigrants, right, and Hispanic immigrants, right, people who are like myself. And that process is still happening, but it also happened along with this parallel process of all these border tensions with Mexico and so on, so that a good chunk of the United States actually used to be Mexico and so on. And you had people being pushed back and forth and back and forth. And right now we're sort of in a period of, you know, what does this mean? Do we build a big old fence? Or do we let people come in and let their kids get college degrees and so on?
Reiner, you call this generation Generation Mix in a paper that you wrote a few years ago. And I want to understand what the millennial generation, how they see their own connection to racial identity. How would you describe that?
Well, I would say, that the term Generation Mix that I use is kind of a bit of sarcasm, because that's the term that one of the several terms that you see bandied about over the last 10 or so years. The question of how they see themselves, I think they see themselves as different and as special and as something new. That's a perspective I don't necessarily agree with, however.
And why not?
I think it sort of devalues, or it tends to take the idea of race mixing and present it as a brand new phenomenon of this millennial generation, when in fact race mixing has been going on for, you know, at least 200-300 years in this country. And I think we don't deal with the fact that race is a fallacy, and any identity based on race is also a fallacy. And so when we talk about being more aware today, or about being transcending race, it's sort of stepping over race rather than dealing with race.
No, that's interesting. And actually, I think some of these tweets are reinforcing that. I tweeted out the question, so millennials, do you think you're free of racial attitude baggage of earlier generations? And Jeff tweets back, very the opposite. I think we've convinced ourselves we don't have our parents' problems, mm-hmm. but it's hidden under cautious interaction. And listen to this, Jose, very successful at convincing ourselves that we're fully aware and that ignorance will die off when our parents' generation does. You agree with that?
Absolutely. So I'm a professor, right? So you teach at a university. And I think the other guest does.
Reiner, you know, is too.
Reiner's working at a university too. And you see this a lot with young people. And I've often wondered, you know, was I like this? Is it an artifact of the fact that they're young?
I think that all the time.
That they're young and idealistic?
Yeah.
Or is this different based on our social context now? I see the same thing with gender. You know, people will say these things, oh, I don't see gender, I don't see race, and yet immediately follow up with something that says, no, actually, no, you're still thinking in terms of race. You're still worried about white and black. You're still thinking that those are, I think Reiner points out, you know, fallacies. You know, I prefer the term, you know, they're a social construction. But the reality is people still think in these terms. And I think on the one hand, they're confusing the rhetoric with the realities that we know about how race is constructed. And so they think that, oh, because I am aware of the fact there's a gender problem or a race problem, therefore I'm beyond this problem. And they haven't realized that these things they're literally in your brain. They're literally about how experience has taught you to perceive reality. That when I scan a room, my brain is literally able to pick up and start to process the fact, oh, that one's white, that one's darker skin, probably, oh, I don't know, maybe Indian or Hispanic, something like that. And that your brain is doing this automatically. It's been trained to do that. And I think there's almost, and Reiner can, you know, you can agree or disagree with, but I'd love to hear what you think. There's almost on the part of those of us that do the work, this sense that there's a real arrogance to it, that a lot of people that think they're beyond race or that they're beyond gender, they're getting a little ahead of themselves. And they need to go back to square one and think about how is this really affecting me?
Reiner, what do you think?
No, I agree. I think that that folks are not. I think are in at the bottom. Sort of the bottom line is that we are heavily invested in racial identity, and I come from a rather, you know, what I think extreme position. I don't think it should be extreme, but in the field, I think I'm sort of on the extreme end of being a race transcender. Mm-hmm. I don't think biological race exists. I understand race as a social construction. What I would go a step farther and say that race isn't a social construction or a social reality. Well, race is a social construction. A lot of folks say that race is a social reality. I would say that belief in race is a social reality, and that's mm-hmm. a very different thing.
I really have to ask you to explain that, though. How is that different?
Well, if you say that race is a social construction, you're saying that it doesn't really exist and we have made it out of whole cloth. We've created it.
And why isn't that true?
Well, that you could say it's true. What a lot of sociologists will say is that race is a social reality. And what they do, the key they give themselves when they do that is they, you read just about any introduction or first chapter of a sociology book on race or mixed race, and it'll say something like this: race doesn't exist, race is a biological fallacy. However, because so many people believe in race, we need to essentially act like it's real, and that's the problem with sociology.
Uh-huh.
And so I say that race is not a social reality, but belief in race is a social reality. Look at the argument of witchcraft, let's say, in Salem a couple hundred years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Witchcraft doesn't exist, but belief in witchcraft has real complications for people. See, people also confuse racism with race. Biological race doesn't exist. There's absolutely no basis for the division of people into racial categories. However, because we do it, then racism is a real problem we have to deal with.
Yeah.
And a lot of times when you're a race transcender or someone who's a critic of race, you get unfairly labeled with the baggage that, oh, well, you don't think racism exists. And it's like quite the contrary.
Yeah. Reiner Spencer is one of our guests this morning. He's director of the Afro-American Studies Program at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, and Jose Santos, a somewhat familiar voice here at NPR. He's a professor of anthropology at Metro State University. And if you've just tuned in, this is what we're talking about: interesting surveys around millennials and their views and attitudes on race. Many millennials believe, because they are the most diverse generation of Americans yet, that they are in some ways post-racial, post-racism, that their views on race are advanced, leaving behind a lot of the racial baggage of earlier generations. And as you listen to this conversation this morning, if you're a millennial, self-identify somewhere between 18 and 34 or 35 years old, I want to know if you think the diversity of your generation gives you some kind of special insight or acceptance of racial issues. Do you think you're free of that baggage that I talked about, that other generations have confronted and not so successfully? Talk to me about it on Twitter, as you are. It's at Carrie NPR. Call us, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. And off the page, Steph, what are we hearing?
Kelsey says, I think that it's partially how you were raised and the level of exposure of diversity you get. Both my parents worked in social services, and I was also raised in a very diverse town that I believe is very accepting and open to diversity. However, I went to a small college in Wisconsin, and people who had not been exposed to diversity or had little exposure were very racist and not willing to have an open mind to people who were, quote, unlike them.
Jose, what do you hear there?
I hear a lot of qualifiers. So one of the things that people will do the most when they talk about race is like, okay, yeah, but well, when I was growing up, or the place where I'm from, I've dealt with racism, but where I came from, but in my family, but in my home.
Yeah.
So there's always a lot of qualifiers, right? And I think people are trying to do a couple things there. One, they're trying to say, hey, there is diversity out there, and I did get exposure. Two, I think they're really worried about this moral question. Because let's face it, if we've got this big social fallacy, and I'm comfortable with using Reiner's language there, if we've got this big social fallacy, and you're aware that it's a fallacy, people don't want to be seen as falling for it. They don't want to be seen as bad. They don't want to be seen as evil. So they got to qualify, I'm not one of the bad ones.
So I'm above the fallacy
I'm
that everybody
this,
else
right.
gets caught up in. Yeah.
The other thing I hear is this belief that exposure to diversity means that you're somehow beyond race. And I really have to say, I don't believe that's true. I don't believe that just because you grew up in a neighborhood where there was a Puerto Rican family and an African-American family and a white family all in the same block, I don't think that means that you're that evolved with race. It means you have exposure to people of other races, but you might still hate them for being different from you. Another thing, and this is really dangerous territory, I think when people talk about the relationships they have, that because I've had intimate friendships with people of different races, or I've had a romantic relationship with people of different races, that somehow is a credential. That means that, no, therefore you are beyond race because you're able to talk to somebody, or you're able to be friends with somebody, and you must understand them completely, therefore, and you must understand the social differences between yourself and them. And I think that's a huge leap. That's a very huge leap.
Yeah.
I mean, if we think just of the relationships with our own parents, and that's simply a generational thing, do you think they get you completely? Probably not.
Right.
Do you think you get them completely? I'm going to bet you don't. So why should it be any different with race?
Let me grab a call here from Jason in Minneapolis. Hi, Jason. What's your thought on this? Hey, Jason, go ahead. Oh, shoot. I thought Jason was there, but he's not. Steph, off the page.
Melly says, it's interesting to compare American millennial views on race as compared with millennial views from other country whose populations are more homogenous. When I talk to French or Chinese friends in their early 20s, their view reflect earlier generations who pushed assimilation into the majority culture, whereas young Americans are more accepting of race, gender, cultural diversity.
Okay, let me try Jason because he's introducing an idea I wanted to get at. Jason, you there?
Yeah, hi. Sorry about that.
That's all right. Tell me what you wanted to say.
So just two quick thoughts. As a millennial, you know, one of the things that I think we do well is just talk about things openly.
Uh-huh.
You know, we have a lot of forms of communication using Twitter and things like that. You know, we've had a big showing here in Minneapolis with Black Lives Matter and, like, the May Day Parade and things. So I think that's one strength that we as a generation have is that we're surfacing issues a little bit better. And then on the side note, you know, I have a background in peace studies a little bit, and one of the things I thought was interesting, and it's kind of a good follow-up to this comment one of the guests was saying about just having relationships as not being a transcendence of your biases and things.
Yeah, yeah.
So in, you know, in some of the ethnic conflicts, one of the good indicators of being, to be able to stop violence from happening is if you have cross-cutting relationships across the group so that it kind of humanizes people.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, if people had relationships from group A to group B, there was less likely to be violence in that community versus another one where maybe an outside group came in to do an atrocity or something like that.
Right.
So I'm just kind of curious, in our generation, do we show, you know, statistically, are we having more cross-racial relationships with one another? Or is that about the same as our parents' generation?
Good question. Two good points here. Reiner, I don't want to miss what Jason said first here, though, because I saw that this turned up a lot in some of the surveys of millennials around race, which is, well, we talk about it a lot. We're not afraid to have those tough conversations that our parents had. Does that mean that they are bringing new insight, enlightenment to those conversations because they're willing to bring it up?
Well, Carrie, I think that certainly it's always good to talk. I wouldn't poo-poo talking, you know, one bit, but I think what you have to be careful of is the sort of the significance of talk. The basic problem when you're talking about race, which is similar to gender but very different, and those two are very different from just about any other topic you talk about, is people say they're talking about race and they're more tolerant of diversity. The fact is there. Biological race doesn't exist. So if you say that I am tolerant of those black folk, and I'm tolerant of those white folk, and I'm tolerant of those Native American folk, and I am tolerant of those Asian folk, and even though they're of different races, I am tolerant of them, then you're living in a delusion, because those people can't be categorized that way in the first place. So it's not just that races exist and I'm tolerant of them. The fact is that race doesn't exist, which is a very different conversation. So in some way, I think that this sort of millennial push is missing the point, is the way I'd put it.
Yeah, and Jose, I think Jason was also getting at something that you alluded to earlier, which is if we have cross-racial relationships, does that mean that attitudes are shifting?
Yeah,
right?
And that you can say is true, right? So, for example, the fact that there has been a rise in the number of biracial, multiracial marriages, right? And if you compare that situation to what we had 100 years ago, you can say, okay, this means something's different. But I think it's one thing to have that number as an index for change, and it's another thing to say that means that we've gotten over race. So to go back to Reiner's point, it's that, okay, sure, people are talking. What is the content of what they're saying? Because if they're just talking about, like, oh, I'm okay with you being black.
Yeah, right.
I'm okay with you being black. I'm over race because I'm okay with you being black. I'm not sure that that's really the conversation that's going to take us anywhere. If, on the other hand, it's a conversation that's more than 15 minutes but lasts your whole lifetime and you're able to evolve in your views, right, and perhaps come to the conclusion this whole thing is an illusion, or this is a historical product that's been used to oppress people, or the fact is I was convinced that this was real and now I can see there's something here that I wasn't aware of at first, then that means that conversation is going somewhere. So do I think it is? I think it is a good thing that people are talking about this. But like so many people that are invested in this, I'm worried about, okay, where's the conversation going to go? You know, there's that wonderful thing that happens to you when you're a professor. And I think sometimes as a parent, when you see a student or a young person starting to take these first steps, and there's this part of you that wants to say, oh, okay, but what about this? But what about this? But what about this? And you realize they're just where they're at. They're just where they're at, and they need to take those first steps. And I think that's where the millennial generation is. But I think it has the advantage of it's allowed to talk about this now.
From Twitter here, a listener says, I'm a millennial, and I see more of an avoidance of race discussion than a transcendence of race. And Matthew says, rather than saying post-race, we're simply more culturally competent. And Jose, here's something I wanted to bring up from Adia Wingfield, sociologist at Georgia State University. I thought this was interesting. She says, millennials have this reputation for having adopted this more progressive, forward-thinking viewpoint. At the same time, a lot of the institutions that structure their lives really haven't changed so much. That's true, right?
Not even the universities that they're going to.
Exactly.
Right? So they're going to Harvard, Yale, and Brown, and Princeton, and they're having these great conversations in these classrooms with these wonderful professors. But if you look at the way those faculties are built up, if you look at the number of people who are white, black, Latino, Asian, who are women in engineering departments, for example, that's a great example that we can still point to. That's kind of a problem. That diversity is not there. So I think we're still at the level of this talk. I think I would like the conversation to move towards what are the structural changes we have to make if our real goal here is some kind of equity.
Yeah, and Reiner, I mean, not just the colleges that they're going to, the places that they work. For the most part, it's probably true that the leadership of those organizations is mostly white. I mean, what would you say about these institutions that millennials are moving into in the slow pace of change?
Well, I think, right, slow pace of change is correct. And also, it's kind of a situation of rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic, to use a tired metaphor. When we talk about racial groups, I'm a racial skeptic, so I'm just using language that we understand,
mm-hmm.
okay? When
yeah.
we talk about racial groups, if we talk about differences, if we talk about intermarriage, something Jose brought up before, if we talk about intermarriage and relationships, it's not equally stratified through each group. You'll find that Hispanics and Asians are moving into assimilation and honorary whiteness and full whiteness at a much higher rate than blacks are. We talk about all this millennial generation as the generation of intermarriage. That intermarriage is happening at the Hispanic and Asian nodes of things. Afro-Americans are still not intermarrying with whites in anywhere near the same number. So it's not even, and it's a reinforcement of what has been our racial structure in this country for the last 300 years, which is that people of sub-Saharan African descent are at the bottom of the pile. And so even if one of the main arguments of sort of the multiracial movement is that it's making race, it's destroying race, it's eliminating the idea of race, just look at all the intermarriage. Well, the intermarriage is happening between whites and Asians and whites and Hispanics, and it's not happening between whites and blacks and anywhere near the same number. So I'm not seeing very much difference.
Let me take a call. Go ahead.
I think we really need to take Reiner's point here. I think looking at the experiences of multiracial Americans kind of gives you a window into how this works and the realities or non-realities of race and how it gets people to treat people differently. So if you look at how the statistics on how people who are mixed white and mixed Asian and their experiences of life and their experiences of discrimination versus those who are mixed white black, white Asian will more likely resemble white people, mainstream white people, in terms of the discrimination they faced, how they've been persecuted and so on. Whereas people who are mixed white black have a very different life experience. So mixing doesn't mean I think very few people are left that probably believe this, but it needs to be said. Just mixing doesn't mean that you get accepted by everybody. Not at all.
Why do you think people don't believe that?
I think it's naivety. I think people are naive and people want to think. I think people want to get over race because it's uncomfortable, because it is kind of this gaping wound in the side. And they want to say, you know, it doesn't matter. We got past that. We're over that. People don't want to think of themselves as bad, and they don't want to think of their nation as a bad place, and they don't want to think of their nation as this backward place. But here we have this one particular issue or set of issues where we look really bad. Ferguson was a
bad immigration, Black Lives Matter, right.
Black Lives Matter, yeah. All that. It's really ugly. And the temptation is to say, well, that's because people are complaining about something that they don't understand. Mm. They just need to move beyond it. They need to get over it. But we're dealing with some harsh social problems.
And
if I could just
go ahead,
just piggyback onto that, what this nation wants, it desperately wants to be post-racial, which is why you saw, you know, Obama's elected. We're post-racial.
That's what I was
Obama's
thinking
re-elected,
about, right.
We're post-racial. You know, Black Lives Matter shows you we're not post-racial. What this country actually wants to do is the easy thing. It wants to be post. It says it wants to be post-racial. Really, what it wants to be is post-black. That's really what it wants to be, to step over the black problem, to not deal with it, and to say that, we've solved it. And those folk who are still complaining Black Lives Matter, they're kind of retrograde. They're holding on to things that we've bypassed, and that's really not the case.
Yeah, I think to put it in other language very quickly, I think it's largely about shame. It's about wanting to duck shame. It's about wanting to say all these things that these black people are talking about, those aren't real. We shouldn't feel ashamed of ourselves. We've got nothing to feel bad about. And I think it's we want to move past the conversation.
Step off the page.
Yeah, Steve says, this desire to be able to claim I'm not one of the bad ones, a desire I very much relate to, is such a barrier to us as white people in confronting structural racism in our society. It makes us defensive, prone to unproductive, shameful feelings, and prevents us from seeing the many ways that our actions and inaction perpetuate inequity.
If you're listening to this discussion with Jose Santos and Reiner Spencer this morning, as a millennial, I'm interested in what you're hearing in the conversation. Do you feel that because you are part of the most diverse generation in American history, that you're free of some of that racial baggage that older generations have struggled to confront? How do these conversations sound among what, your family members, your friends at school, or your friends at work? 800-242-2828, 651-227, 6000. Lots of feedback here on Twitter. Listener says, if you claim to be colorblind, then you ignore institutional racism and how it impacts us all. Eric says, if racial baggage is still here, how can we be free from it? We have to deal with the consequences of our past and heal to be free. And to the phones to Brenda in St. Paul. Hey, Brenda, thanks for waiting.
Good
Hi.
Morning.
Hi.
Thank you. I come from someone for whom this really matters because my household represents the world. And what I still believe is that I still agree with the speakers that biological race does not exist. So just like we can add words to our vocabulary, I think it's time to retire the word race. And that really what we're talking about are cultural differences, and cultural differences are learned behaviors, period.
Let me ask our guests about that, Brenda. That's an interesting statement. Reiner, how comfortable are you with the idea of that?
Well, you know, what I would be more interested in is getting folks educated about the concept of race, because I think that if you simply sort of switch trade race for culture without any other deep understanding of what you're doing, any deep deconstruction of what you're doing, then it's just a euphemism. Right. So I think I'm less concerned about getting rid of the word than getting rid of the belief that there are different folk. Certainly cultural differences make up a lot of it. But I would not want to get rid of the word talk. I don't want us to get rid of the word race and therefore stop talking about race until everyone is on the same sheet, which is what we are now. We're in a flat earth kind of position.
Meaning?
Right. It's like belief in a flat earth. And we don't want to just change the terminology. We want to make sure people understand, no, the earth is not flat.
Jose?
Right. I have to agree. I think I think it would actually be dangerous to sort of trade the word race for culture, because those are separate things. Culture is real. Culture is very, very real. Whereas race is constructed largely by culture. And so I think, you know, I hate to sound like a professor, but this is in some ways about educating people. This is in some ways about when you use the word race, what do you mean? When you use the word racism, what do you mean? I think for a lot of people, they're always going to be able to say, I'm not racist, because of the way that they've defined racist. Racist only means you use the N-word, you know, you wear a hood, or you say horrible things, like my grandfather used to say. Whereas when academics use the word racism, we're talking about something different, right? So I think we need to have a conversation about what is this thing that we're talking about and how does it actually work? Because we have evidence as to what the effects of race are, what the effects of racism are, how it works in your brain, how it works in institutions. And those are things that people just don't know.
You know, Jose, as I was thinking about this show and where the conversation was going to go, I remembered those surveys where they ask Americans, black and white and different races, how they think race relations have progressed or not since President Obama was elected. And when you ask Americans of color about that, you get very different answers than you do from white Americans. And that right there tells us volumes, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think, again, there'd be people that would say, well, that tells us that Americans of color are deluded and aren't understanding it. But I think if you take a step back kind of from the prejudice and the bias, you see, wait a second, why are these two populations having drastically different experiences in the same country?
Right.
And that's an empirical question. That's a question we got to look at. Well, how do these things affect their lives differently? How do these things affect their perceptions differently? What is the basis of each one of these groups answering these questions differently? And it's because the experience of people of color in this country is different than the experience of white people in this country.
You know, Reiner, I think when Jose says, well, the reaction from many white Americans, what do you want? I mean, what's your problem? Why can't you see the progress? Is true, don't you?
Well, certainly, yes. How long does it take to get over, you know, so slavery ended, you know, many, many years ago, right? How come black folk can't get their act together? A lot of it has to do with, just to take one particular point, with inheritance, inherited wealth, moving wealth from one generation to another. I don't know what the statistics are, but I would pretty much guarantee you that it's a very, very low percentage of blacks who at the end of their lives can take a sum of money and give it to the next generation. Mm-hmm. When your family is able to do that for you and you've got an inheritance, whether it is a sort of an intellectual inheritance that gets you into Harvard or Yale without actually having to test in, or it's an inheritance of cash or real estate, when you've got that from generation to generation to generation, that allows you to continue to progress. When you don't have that, then from generation to generation to generation, you are simply sort of living hand to mouth. I can tell you that in my family, so if I were a believer in race, you would call me, I could say I'm black, white, mixed race. I'm a race transcender. However, the average person would look at me as black. As a middle-class black person, I'm the first person in any one of my families, in my various family lines, to be able to pass wealth on to my children. The first.
Kelia says on Twitter, at racial disparities in infant mortality rates, physical and mental health outcomes, frequency of stress-related diseases, all indications that racism is not, race issues are not solved. She says, look at racial achievement gaps, representation in STEM fields and politics, appalling justice system outcomes. I think I read those tweets in reverse. Steph, off the page.
T. Goldberg says, I agree. Race, in quotes, does not exist. So stop using the word. Use other terms, ethnicity, culture, traditions, genealogy. And Kim says, I don't believe racism is the issue. I believe classism is the issue. I don't believe society is making discriminatory judgments as much on the color of skin as for where someone is from in the country.
I don't believe that.
Yeah,
do you?
But I think it's a very common thing. So sometimes if you're doing diversity work, people will pick a sort of a party line about race or class. Like I've literally heard these conversations, you know, that you're having sort of a meeting with the race people. And they're like, okay, but how are the class people going to respond when it comes to this? And I think what I do like, you know, I hate to pat academics on the back for anything, but is our notion of intersectionality has really helped us develop this so that people thought it was an either or. Oh, it's a race problem or a class problem. And then you realize, no, these are social categories that intersect.
For the reasons that Reiner just gave us, right?
Yeah, exactly. So that and also I think the use of the language of privilege, talking about white privilege, I think without explaining clearly what we're talking about when we use the term has really cut off a lot of people.
What do we mean when we say it?
I think for a lot of people, when they say white privilege, I'm not privileged. My grandfather didn't leave me an inheritance. My father didn't leave me an inheritance. I've got to work, you know, I work with my hands. I'm not privileged. And they're talking about class, right? They're talking about the issue of class. And I think class is extremely important. We can't delude ourselves that it's not important. But when we talk about racial privilege or white privilege, it's the things that don't have to do with class, what purely comes from your race. So for in my case, I've got class privilege, right? Like my father paid for me to go to college. That's an amazing amount of class privilege. I don't necessarily have the racial privilege. So that means that when I was at college, my friends, you know, jokingly, there's the Nacho boy. There's Nacho, right? That's not my name. But it's funny, right? And he's the one Hispanic guy here, so we got to give him crap for it and things like that. That's something that they, because they're white, had the privilege of not having to go through.
And it's like gender privilege, right?
Yeah.
I mean, there are so many ways that I'm privileged because I'm male. I mean, incredibly, you know. So I mean, there's different kinds of privilege. You can be privileged in one way and not privileged in another. So yeah. I think the sort of male female example is an easy way to see how white privilege works. Just because I'm male, even in a racial situation, there's things I get just because I'm male.
Right. And I think the problem is maybe it's something, you know, that has to do with the U.S. When we hear the word privilege, people automatically think, oh well, I'm not rich, so I must not be privileged.
Right.
So we get caught.
Doesn't mean social. They don't think of it as social structure, inherent benefits, right? That accrue to you that you didn't ask for and you don't know you need.
Or it can also just be that you're not being privileged can just mean that you're not disprivileged.
Got it.
Yeah.
It's just normal for you.
Yeah, because there is a movement to sort of change the language of it. And it's like, well, privilege, these are things that everybody should have a right to. And it's everybody else, people like myself, have been deprived of those things. Right. So it is an artifact of the language we're using right now.
Joe says online, people in the millennial generation are more open to talking to other people. Instead of talking about race, they talk about shared interests, but they're still exhibiting learned behavior. So it's positive, but not enough. And step off the page.
Dave says go into any corporate lunchroom or even a college library and one still sees many of the same races together. I know an HR recruiter at Target who said that if a person of color was hired and wasn't married to a local within 2 to 3 years, that person of color would return to their hometown due to lack of acceptance. Got a lot of nice talk, but there's a long gap to close.
To the phones to Kay in St. Paul. Hi, Kay.
Hi. Hi. This is a great conversation. I agree with everything with your guest, but I was listening, I felt like a lot of this is from the perspective of white millennials and as a person of color. I feel like we uphold the systems of oppressions as well, and I think that sometimes people of color might be aware of maybe the oppression they experience, but maybe they don't understand the, maybe if you're a man, you don't understand the systems of oppression for women, or you don't understand the ways all these systems of oppression intersect. And so I think that the conversation, though, is really great. I think it's missing a component that people of color also uphold the oppressive systems as well. And I'll just take my comment off here.
Sure. Reiner, do you think that's true?
Well, I mean, certainly I would agree with that because we're all in a system. Right, we're all hegemonized. So there's a real scholarly word for you. It means that there's a system out there that has convinced us all that it's an okay system and we're a part of it. We're part of the hegemony also. The biggest case, I would say that from my perspective of black folk, is they buy into the one-drop rule. Right, which says that if you've got one drop of black blood, obviously, you know, a huge metaphor here, that you're therefore black. You have any black ancestry, any sub-Saharan African ancestry, you're therefore they're therefore black. This was a system put in place during slavery time so that slave owners got the benefit of their those slave children being that they fathered being considered black and therefore property. But today it is black folk are the most ardent proponents of the one drop rule because it in fact has served as a way to bring people together and to sort of shield them, but at the same time it keeps them heavily invested in the idea of biological race and heavily invested in the idea of race as an identity. And I think that one of the hardest conversations you can have is to talk to black folk and say, strip off your racial identity, and I dare you to strip off your racial identity and see what's left. That's incredibly frightening for the average black person.
Wow. Jose?
I think I have to agree. I think a lot of times people people who aren't white, right, whether it's black, Latino, whatever, almost use their race as a credential to say they're not racist. And it, there's a horrible irony in that, because if race is a fallacy, as Reiner's pointing out, or in my case, you know, I see more of a social construction, you're still believing in it, right? Doesn't mean that you're somehow beyond it. And I think a really good example is the
horrible... In other words, you're saying if you're investing a lot of your identity in this social construction,
yeah,
you're believing it.
Yeah,
you're...
yeah. That means, yeah, that it's real for
it's
you.
It's the and same thing.
Yeah, it's the same thing. Now, I however, don't think that people need to erase, you know, their pride in their race or whatever. But I think it needs to evolve. It needs to be something that's more aware, and it needs to be aware of the constructed aspect of it. But I think when it gets to, and he's very right about this, talking to people who are not white about racism themselves. And I think because there's so much hurt and there's so much desire, really, and if you hear a lot of the rhetoric, it is about, you know, how do we position ourselves against white America in order to create an identity? But if you look at just some of the worst, most racist things I've heard is between minorities, between minority groups. And in fact, I think one way of getting a good lens at this, and what we love doing in anthropology, is cross-cultural comparison. If you think race is real, look at how race is constructed in different places and different locations. And you will see how, oh, it's completely different from the way we do it here. So, for example, me, I'd be considered Latino. I would get lumped in with so many different ethnicities, in fact, right? Whether it's people who are, say, a pure Mayan blood, people who are mestizo, people who are white Argentinians, whatever it might be. But in my experience, actually, the most racist place I've ever been is Guatemala.
Wow.
And it's people distinguishing shades of brown and degrees of Indianness. So that actually the word indio is an insult. It's what people who are driving along in their cars and somebody cuts them off in front, they yell out the window, indio, like that. And that's a very different conception of race than what we have here, right? It's completely different, because I think everybody in Guatemala here would get lumped together as Hispanic or Latino.
Right.
And so you need to have those experiences to see, no, this applies everywhere to everyone. It isn't just a white problem. What we can say is, looking at the history of the United States, is that, yeah, we have lived in a society of white dominance, and that has made it difficult for everybody else.
Jose, thank you very much. Good to have you here.
Thank you so much.
Reiner, thank you very much for getting up early in Las Vegas. I hope you'll come back.
Hey, this was a lot of fun. I appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.